Well, I want to start by thanking God for that beautiful prayer. It brings back all sorts of memories for me. I went traveling with my family in Turkey, and we went to Konya, which is where Rumi is buried. That's the old Iconium that Paul went to visit. And there's a wonderful burial site there, and we also had a chance to see the swirling dervishes, as we call them, which, that's a real prayer form in action. It's got its own choreography and its music and these men dancing with the right hand to the ground, with that way, the right to the ground, the left to the sky. It's a wonderful experience. So thank you for that memory. Well, I've got the beginning of part two of The People's History of Christianity, chapter four, which is the kind of introduction to the Middle Ages, and then chapter five, which is the love of God section. Now, each period has a love of God section and a love of neighbor section. And Tom's going to do the love of neighbor section next time. Well, as I was getting ready for this, I realized two things about this book. One is that it's hard to totally ignore what Diana Butler Bass calls Big C Christianity, the official structures and the situation around us. And on the other hand, there is so much of generative Christianity that it's hard to know what to pick. Now, Diana has picked out her favorite pieces of, I'm tempted to say, rummage. Do you remember that that image of what the church goes through every 500 years? It has to hold a rummage sale, and it goes through and looks at its stuff and what's good or not. Well, there's an awful lot of good rummage, good treasures stored in our attics that can be looked at. And I'm going to touch on some of them and maybe find a few others along the way that appeal to me. Here's where I've got to learn to use this. The other thing that I was thinking as I was preparing was that I happened to take part in a telecast of Richard Rohr's a couple of weeks ago. And he had this quotation from Tertullian, who was a Latin theologian of the 3rd century. Caro salutis est cardo. The flesh is the hinge of salvation. Our salvation depends on the flesh. That's not something we usually hear too much about, is it? I think in his context, he was addressing those people who were overly spiritual, maybe denied the flesh. But I had a couple of things that I was thinking about. Of course, we have to love God and our neighbor in the flesh, or it's useless, right? Mm-hmm. So, in that sense, we need the flesh. But the other thing one other thing I was thinking about in terms of the church living through history. The church is often depicted as a human being, usually a woman, and I think the image of the church as a human being is important. But a human being has to have flesh and bone, right? The bone is kind of the structures. Now, if you just have the bone without the flesh, you get a skeleton, and that's a symbol of death. On the other hand, if you only have the flesh, it's kind of not really a body with any shape. And if the bones aren't healthy, and we're at the age where we're dealing with osteoporosis, arthritis, and things like that, the church isn't healthy either. So that was one of the things that was running through my mind. But I also wanted to deal with the flesh, because that's where generative Christianity is. That's the contrast to Big C Christianity in this book. It seems to me that it's what you can see and hear and touch and feel. And so I'm going to be mainly dealing, Tom did a good bit with the hearing bit, right, with the music. I leave that to him. And the refreshment people will take care of taste. I don't have any smells. I didn't drink candles or incense. But I'm going to do a lot with pictures. So, and the other thing I want to say is I'm hoping we can, you know, give our own responses here and now to any of these pictures. So feel free to raise your hand, make a comment or anything as we go along. Okay. Oops. Skip. Back. Well, I'm going to try to avoid Big C Christianity, but I thought I'd better start with it. This is Big C Christianity. Of about 500, this is a depiction, very unusual, of Jesus Christ as a Roman soldier. You could see the little skirt that he has, and you can see he's conquering a lion and a snake. It's perhaps not too surprising to realize that this is from one of the power centers of the 5th century, of the early 6th century. Now let me point out that this is something that may be new to Catholics. Rome is not the center of the Christian community at this point. Most of the action's occurring in the East. After all, what happened? Rome was the capital of the pagan Roman Empire. Constantine indeed made Christianity legal, and he favored Rome with a lot of building of churches. All on the outskirts of the town, he didn't want to disturb the pagans who were still very powerful in the center. So he built a church for the Bishop of Rome, named John Lateran, not St. Peter's. And he built churches around the outsides in the cemetery over the grave sites of the martyrs, which were outside town because the Romans didn't want the dead coming in and interfering with the living. So Constantine built these churches, but then he moved his capital to Constantinople. So that's where the real power center is. He did have to sometimes come back and deal with the western part of his empire. But the emperors moved their headquarters for that to Milan. And the reason for that was that the natives up north were getting restless. And then when it got too dangerous in Milan, they moved that western headquarters to Ravenna. You know, you can tell Ravenna is sort of south of Venice on the east side of the peninsula, closer to Constantinople. And this depiction is in the Archiepiscopal Chapel, the private chapel of the Archbishop of Ravenna.
What does he have in his right hand? I can't see it.
In his right hand.
It's a staff.
The staff, yeah. A staff of office, I guess.
It's a staff. It's just a long staff.
Yeah, and some of them even think it might be a sort of a cross thing, but I...
There is no book on it.
There's no book on it.
It's for clobbering people.
Anyway, all that to say that we still have to deal with Big C Christianity. But a lot of generative Christianity is often very different places. Take this where the emperor isn't breathing down your neck, for example. Or even his delegates. So, does anyone know where this is? Oh, why is it doing that?
You got to just flick it, or let me do it. Tell me if you like.
Okay. Ireland. So we're gonna go to St. Brendan and the Irish example. Ireland is very interesting. And of course, it developed a very different kind of Christianity. Partly because it was evangelized differently. You know, this wasn't evangelized by St. Paul traveling from city to city along Roman roads and visiting the local synagogue. Because it was rural. There were no Roman roads. There had never been any Romans in Ireland. They didn't get that far. And so when it was evangelized, it was five, Patrick and Palladius and others, just going and setting up a little center. It was like a little monastery. And they would set up a very simple little church. This is called the Galerith Oratory. It's in County Kerry on the southwest side. There's a little tiny window on the wall that you can't see on the other side, opposite the door. And this is how it began in Ireland. They must have been intrepid people, because the works they created out of Ireland were extraordinary. They did build up monasteries, which were their bases for going out and doing missionary work. They became schools for training clergy, places for producing books. We all know about the Book of Kells. And they even became the place where the bishops resided when they eventually got appointed. But the abbots were just as influential as the bishops, so you've got a very different Christianity there. And as the legend of St. Brendan points out, they were intrepid seafarers going out to different places. I suppose that was their form of the desert. You know, St. Anthony in the early church went out to the desert. Well, you could go out to the bogs of the forests of Ireland, or you could go out to the waves of the North Atlantic. Obviously my touch is not very good. This is Skellig Michael off the southeast coast of Ireland. And I've never been there. I wanted to go there, but if you even go to the southeast corner of Ireland, they'll tell you if it's safe to go there, whether the boats are running. This is the monastery on Skellig Island. Those are the little beehive huts or kulkans that the monks would have lived in.
When did they just end? What year?
The monastery, they think, goes back to the 7th century. So this is a little later than the earliest, 4th, 5th century.
How do you spell it?
Skellig.
Yeah.
S-K-E-L-L-I-G. And then Michael. Let's see if I can make this turn just one at a time. Okay. There's St. Brendan. Now, St. Brendan really existed, we think. Let me see what he's supposed to have. Somewhere I have where his date is. Watch my time. Oh, gosh. I better watch my time. The stories about him date from much later, and they're very fanciful. But he apparently did make this big voyage to the Isles of the Blessed that says, we don't know where they are. I mean, was it North America? Somewhere in the news, there was some story about how he made it to North Texas. I don't think so somehow. Some people say, oh, he made it as far as the Orkneys, but whatever. And as you can see from the hand, he didn't go alone. He went with pilgrims, some stories say 14. Some people, some say 60. They went with a bunch of other people, they say. And he had some adventures along the way, including this one, where he landed on what he thought was an island, and it turned out to be a big fish. What was that?
No, just wait for me, I'll just change the slide.
Okay.
Ready?
Yeah, sure. There's another picture of it. Apparently the fish woke up, so they built a fire on it. Anyway, Brendan is a very good way to talk about how the Irish did go out to various places. And they sent their monks. Colombo went to Iona, off the west coast of Scotland. And from there, Aidan went to Lindisfarne. Is this doing the right thing?
It's doing fine.
Okay. And Columbanus went to Gaul, so we're going into France, and they even got down to Bobbio in northern Italy. So there was a real evangelizing movement coming from the Irish.
Here are they speculating that the Blessed Isles were
Canaries? Actually, that's one of the theories, yeah. Okay. Now we're going to go somewhere else. We're going to go back to something a little bit closer to home. This is near Rome. It's Subiaco. You can get away from the center by going into a kind of wild place. Subiaco is only 40, 50 miles from Rome, but it is up a very narrow valley, as you can see. No, not quite yet. I want to just say that's a much more modern building. What he did was go and live in a cave. Okay. Yes. So this is Saint Benedict with a couple of the boys. He took in, he founded a school for boys. Now I know nowadays we immediately think the wrong thing. But one of them was Saint, one we know is Saint Maurus, and the other one was Saint Placidus. And actually, this is a, he had his troubles with, both with the local priests who didn't like him coming in and setting up this monastery and school, and also with some of the monks who got upset at him. And some of them, the story is, tried to poison him by giving him some poisoned wine, but the cup broke miraculously. And then there was an occasion they tried to poison his bread. Well, he had a pet raven, and he knew that this was happening, so he told the pet raven to go and take the bread somewhere else. So he did. So that's what the raven is doing up there. Yes. Now, the person who tells us the most about Saint Benedict is surprised, Pope Gregory the First. And there he is writing one of his books that might be the dialogues in which he talked about that.
I think it was taking dictation, music dictation.
Well, yeah, we'll get to that in a minute. He did a lot of things. Incidentally, this in view of what was written about in the Independent today, he was the great-great-grandson of Pope Felix III.
Yeah.
So much for the idea that celibacy and unmarried men were were the rule in the early church. Now, his family was a very important Roman family. In fact, he'd been a prefect of the city of Rome, which meant he was in charge of administering things and seeing that the law enforcement worked and everything else. He didn't like it. He decided to become a monk. He turned his own house into a monastery. And then the Pope of the time said, I need you to do something else. So he became a deacon, which again meant tending to the poor of the city of Rome, basically. And then he said, I need you to go off to Constantinople and persuade the emperor to send troops against the Lombards. You know, Rome had been destroyed by the Goths in 410. Then came the Vandals. Then came the Huns. At this point, the Bishop of Rome is trying to persuade the Franks to help him against the Lombards. I mean, it's just one thing after another. So Gregory was sent off to Constantinople, which he hated, came back, went to his monastery, and then lo and behold, the Pope died of the plague, because Rome was very malarial. So the people said, we want you to be Pope. They nominated him by acclamation. The process was the people proposed this, and then they had to get the approval of the emperor. So Gregory wrote the emperor and said, I don't want this, don't say yes. But he did. So the poor guy ended up being Pope against his will, actually. But he did a lot of things, in addition to writing the stories of St. Benedict, incidentally, including all of those miracle stories, which he evidently believed. And of course, he sent St. Augustine to Canterbury, our Episcopalians know that. The other thing he got to be known for was liturgical music. That may have been because St. Benedict's monastery, you know, St. Benedict lived in Subiaco, then went to Monte Cassino, but that was destroyed by the Lombards, and they took refuge in Rome. And the previous Pope, Pelagius, had set them to work on liturgy. the Benedictines are still very good with liturgy. We don't really know exactly how. We do know that Pope Gregory was very fond of the Benedictines, but we don't know whether he actually created the music. But here he is writing. Do you notice there's a bird perched on his shoulder? That's a dove that's inspiring him. So here we have the music. I think that's a stylistic detail you'll find all over the place. But I love that. It's a beautiful ivory, yeah.
Next.
Yes, next. Okay, I just wanted to say a little bit more about the monks. This is a different, the Benedictines lived together. They would found guest houses. They were known for their hospitality in many places. But there are many other ways that people try to live together in a communal life or not so communal life. This is Camaldoli. This was one of the very fun places we visited when we were living in Italy. It's up in the Apennines in the mountains, east of Florence, north of Arezzo. And they have a big guest house in the town of Camaldoli, but they also recognized that sometimes people needed to get away. So if you needed to get away, you would come to this little hermitage, and you would have your own little cell, a two-room little cell with a garden outside, and you would have your bedroom, and then you'd have your study. And Tom found a couple of slides. These are modern, obviously. So that shows the setup. There's a monk in his little study, and here he is having his meals brought to him. Because someone would bring you your meals, but you would eat by yourself. And there was a third stage, too. If you really wanted to be alone, you could go up the hill into a totally separate place. But that's just some of the flowering of monasticism. I think next we're going to a very non-monastic place. This is what she opens her book with, Chartres Cathedral. And the daytime shot. Did we put in the nighttime shot? Mm-hmm. Here, I think I'm going to come over so I can. Okay, let's keep going. Okay, oh, that's the famous labyrinth.
Which right in the center of the cathedral.
Right in the center of the cathedral.
Where is this?
Chalice.
It's number two on that graphic.
Yeah, well, that's just the floor plan of it. And I'm not going to really deal with where the windows are and all that. Mm-hmm. That's a rose window. This, of course, was one of the very early monuments of Gothic architecture. Mm-hmm. But we're going to go to the Good Samaritan window, which is the one that's in the book. Mm-hmm. And that's the shape of it. And I think I'm going to start at the very top.
Yeah, the top half is?
The top half is the creation and fall of Adam and Eve, and the bottom half is the Good Samaritan. So I thought we'd try to put some flesh on the chapter by showing you this. Okay, that's the top. That's Christ blessing the world. You can see his right hand is in blessing, kind of greeting the whole world. It's a very positive image, I think. And, okay, let me see. That must be...
This is the creation
That's
of
the
Adam.
Creation of Adam.
And breathing into Adam's mouth.
Oh, yes. You see the two lines there?
Breathing life into
Adam. So he's breathing life into Adam. There's Adam sitting contentedly under his tree
right.
In paradise. And you can see what's going to happen next. There he is. He's kind of lying back like this, and Eve is being pulled out of his rib.
Look at the facial characteristic of God. Okay.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Notice this. There's the God that is, but look at, he's got a halo around with a cross in it. That is very typical. And if you think about that, think about the opening words of St. John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then it goes on to how the world was created through God, and without the Word, nothing was made. There's the Word of God. It's the same one that's overseeing the whole creation, who's also kind of in charge of everything that flows out of it. There he is giving his warning to Adam and Eve, don't eat of the tree. And here they are looking at the tree. These are 800-year-old windows. Some of them aren't terribly clear anymore. But there they are eating of it. Here they are hiding from God. You notice they've got a little something over their sensitive areas. And there's a tree here. And there's God. Where are you, Adam? And here they are being expelled from the gate. This is the gate of paradise, this red thing here. And there's the angel with his sword, and he's expelling them from the garden. Here they are, there's their punishment. There's Adam, he's delving, you know, he's digging the earth at the foot of his brow. And Eve is doing what women always had to do, right? Spinning, that seems to be the archetypal women's work. That's God sort of watching what's going on. Ah, well, so that didn't do very well. And here's the end of the story. Here's the first crime. That's Cain. And you can see he's bopping Abel over the head. So, that's the top of the thing. Then we come to another crime. Except it starts out with this innocent traveler who is leaving the walls of Jerusalem. Here he is going along the way, and someone is drawing out his sword or his knife behind him. And here they are. The others have joined him. They've ganged up on him. They're taking his clothes off. Here's the priest and the Levite. They see him lying there in a lump.
Yeah, the priest is dressed very much like a Catholic.
Yeah, look at that.
They're
going to
bring an olive and
a chest. Yeah, I imagine. I mean, these are professional glaziers who are making this thing. They imagined it the way they saw them.
And the Levite
carrying his book. Well, then along comes the Good Samaritan.
Look at the facial characteristics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not too much different from the Jesus we've been seeing, is it? Mm-hmm. He sees the man, puts him on his horse, takes him to the inn. See the horses there in the inn? They're feeding trough.
That's the
innkeeper opening the door. That's all four of them. And here's the man lying in his bed and being cared for by the Good Samaritan. And here's Jesus telling the parable. We're now at the bottom of the window. The very bottom thing is Jesus telling the parable. And then on the corners, here are the shoemakers. They're the ones who donated the window. Here they are at work. Here they are at work again. And here they are. This is the window that they are presenting.
I think I can recognize Hugh and maybe John over there in the corner. Right? You can almost see their faces.
Well, of course, I mean, this is how the windows were built. They were donated. I mean, they were paid for by the different guilds. And we know what some of them were because they've got their little signatures. Mm-hmm. The story of Noah, for example, was donated by the barrel makers. Mm-hmm. Why? Well, I guess you could think about building ships, but it seems the more likely thing is that Noah also planted the first vines. Mm-hmm. This is France, after all. And when you make wine, you have to store it in barrels. So you get the sense that this was a community project. This wasn't some church given by an emperor. This was made by the locals. Granted, Sharp was a flourishing city. It had a school for a couple of centuries. But, you know, it's a people's project. It's also known for its sculpture, and I can't show you very much of it, and I'm not going to show you the best sculpture, but I was intrigued by this bit. These are just very tiny, oops, you take me, the first one, very tiny sculptures along the edge of one of these archivolts, and it's It's a description of prayer. It's a contemplative life. The other side has active life. It has women working with. Did I do that?
Don't worry about it. I'll just.
I don't know that. So this is how you pray. First, on the left, go back.
I will.
You recollect yourself. And then you open your book. You can see her opening her book. Then you read your book. Then you lay your book aside and you pray. And when you've done that, you're in a position to start talking. You can teach. She's got her hand raised because that's the teaching position. And the long life of prayer, you can be in a kind of ecstasy or a communion with God. And that's the final one. Yeah, I'm not sure the hands are still there. This is a pretty old sculpture. But I was intrigued by this. And particularly with the fact that they're bringing in books. Now, but before I get to that, I want to go back. This is one of the oldest windows in Charleston. It's a very tall window, and it survived the fire of 1194. At that time, it was only the central panel because the windows were narrower before they learned to structure the building so they could have wider windows. So the angels around the outside were added later. But it's a very typical picture of Mary. And this is something Diana Butler Boss doesn't talk about the growth of this affection for Mary that is so evident in the Middle Ages. This is a traditional scene you see in a lot of sculpture from the, quote, Dark Ages, unquote. It's Mary as the throne of wisdom, which is to say, what you see is a rather formal-looking baby Jesus looking very wise, sitting on Mary's lap. Jesus is wisdom. Mary is the throne. You can go show the sculptures.
There's two more.
Two more examples of them. Now, you could say Jesus is the wisdom, but I think it kind of bleeds over because Mary becomes wise in the process, too. And this is kind of something that I've been interested in. I think I'm going back. Here I'm going backwards a little bit. We're going to the Eastern Church. This is my nod to the icons. I don't know how well you can see with this light. This is an Annunciation scene. And you can see the angel coming in from the left. Here's Mary. There's God above in that circle of gold. Here's the Holy Spirit coming there. Mary seated on a throne. And she's got in her hand a spindle. There she is working again. Now, according to the ancient stories, this was no ordinary wool she was spinning. This was the red, the scarlet wool to make the curtain of the temple. So this wasn't ordinary. This was not an ordinary thing. But that's what she's doing. And here's an icon from a later time. Maybe you can see the red and the scarlet. That's what she was doing, and that's what she continued to do in the East. But in the West, we get a different iconography, starting in the 9th century. She's got a book. So she's literate. She's praying, just like the ones in the Archibald.
It's about a 1300, from about 1300. It's a woven book cover in England.
Well, this is fabric. This is interesting. But you see it in on the gospel book covers, and we see it in all sorts of places. You see it in vestments. This is a much later one, of course. This is a Fra Angelico from Prado, I think. And there's her book on her knee. So this became the Western way of showing Mary. Traditionally, and you can see this on some annunciations, she's reading that piece of Isaiah where it says, "Behold, a virgin shall bear a child." And I had to show you this one too, because I love it. This is St. Anne teaching Mary to read.
There's a little stick in her hand, too.
Yeah, there's a little bit. And they have identified the psalm. It's Psalm 148. So this ties right in with Diana's chapter on the books of the hours. I mean, that's what Mary was reading, right? That's what St. Anne is teaching Mary to read. Let's see. I wanted to say, at least show you a little bit. This is my nod to Abelard and Eloise. Now that, of course, is a story of another educated woman. You notice, I think Diana Butler Bloss liked it bad. I keep saying Bloss. Bad liked educated women. Even when talking about Benedict, she talked about Scholastica. So that's my nod to it. And of course, she was required to take the veil. And Peter Abelard wrote all about it in a book which he called The Story of My Calamities, which seems to have been his way of kind of repeating the confessions of St. Augustine. Remember how St. Augustine had trouble with his concubine? He decided he couldn't conquer his sexual lust, so he finally got rid of her. Well, that's sort of what happened with Abelard. So, of course, he had the additional push of having been castrated. Now, this is probably fake. I mean, this is much later, obviously. This tomb, which is in Paris.
Yeah,
in the Père Lachaise Cemetery. It was erected a lot later, and they say the bones are there, but others say no, it's only an empty thing. But, you know, the story obviously became very popular. That manuscript I showed you was from a French roman de la Rose. It was kind of a romance. Came to be very popular and was also roundly condemned by some churchmen. But that's the way it goes.
On to Norwich.
I also wanted to say a little bit of something about Dame Julian. You've read about her, I'm sure, and about the famous showing. The church that she was an anchorist in no longer exists. It had fallen down in disrepair, but then the bombing in World War II also destroyed things. But it was a little parish church. Probably the same kind of structure. And it had a sort of little two-room apartment off of it. You could look into the church itself to say mass, but there's also a window on the street so that she could counsel people who came for her advice. And we know, for example, that Marjorie Kemp, who was a woman of the time, one of the first women to write an account of her adventures, came and talked to Dame Julian. So think of her as being kind of spiritual director who's always there. I mean, you don't have to hunt down the priest. You've got someone, you know where she is.
She's walled into the church.
Now, she did have a servant to come and, you know, bring her food and, you know, things like that. That was the way it went. And this is a little piece of her showing the work she wrote in English. I have a particular favorite passage which I would like to read to you. This came to be very meaningful to me when I discovered I had cancer, actually. Obviously, I'm still here, so. But this is a piece from her showing. And in this he, that is God, showed me a little thing, the size of a hazelnut, lying in the palm of my hand, as it seemed, and it was as round as any ball. I looked upon it with the eye of my understanding and thought, what may this be? And it was answered generally thus, it is all that is made. I marveled how it might last, for I thought it might suddenly have fallen to naught or littleness. And I was answered in my understanding, it lasts and ever shall, for God loves it. And so have all things their beginning by the love of God. So, For anybody who wants a hazelnut, I'm going to put these by the back door. And I use this to pray myself through my own cancer surgery.
One of the things she said was all shall be well.
All shall be well, all will be well. Yeah, all manner of things shall be well. A very positive message from a woman who lived in very tumultuous times. So this reminder is important to me. And with that, I think it's time for a refreshment.
Break, yeah.
Now it's time to indulge our taste. That's the part of the flesh.